All right, tonight we began in Romans chapter 13. Now, without going back and spending time really to review, let us very, very quickly bring us up to date and where we are. Now then, instead of bringing it down, we'll go from chapters 1 through 11, rather than breaking it down any more than that. As we start in chapter 12 through chapter 16 now, this over here was the doctrinal part. Now, what is this part over here? Right, the practical part. The part that now, since this is true, since you are saved by faith, then here is how you ought to live. All right, as we started out then last week in chapter 12 and in verse 1, how is it that we ought to live? I urge you, therefore, since this is true, what now are you to do? Right, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. So that is what we're talking about. You are to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. You are to be transformed. And we used an illustration of that word, meaning that you actually have your form changed, and it's like going from the cocoon to the butterfly. That is a transformation. Now, you're to be transformed in what way? By the renewing of your mind. So you have to go back to that renewing of your mind in order to have this come to pass. Now, in chapter 12, then, we studied about a number of things. Paul is just going bang, 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 hitting this and hitting that. Now, in order for us to understand chapter 13, we have to go back to the very end of chapter 12. Now, keep in mind, when he wrote these chapters, Paul did not write chapter 12 and then put down now chapter 13. You know, and come back and write it 3 days later. He continued right on. The numbers were in there merely for our convenience. So, what is it that he's talking about as he starts out in chapter 13:1? What is the subject matter?
Government governing authorities.
As he starts out, now that's what it is in verse 1, but I mean, we haven't read verse 1 yet. Now here I am getting ready to teach. Look at it. I've got my mouth open. I'm getting ready the first word. What is the subject matter already?
Authority.
What?
Presenting our body.
Yeah, but what is the specific thing we just got through talking about in chapter 12? Alright, vengeance. Right. In other words, do not take vengeance. Now that is important for us to see right here. So look back up here now as you start out in verse... let's see, the best place would be to start out in verse 17. Never pay back evil for evil, or never take vengeance. 18, be at peace with all men as much as in you lieth. 19, never take your own revenge, never take vengeance. The latter part of verse 19, now here's the key, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. All right, now vengeance belongs to God. So what God says is that if your enemy then is hungry, what do? Trump on his head. No, you do him good. See, don't you take vengeance. Don't you pay him back. You do that which is good. Now the reason for that is that God said, vengeance is mine. Now that belongs to me. All right, now we're getting ready to learn a very important lesson. As we're now presenting our bodies to God, as we are renewing our mind, as we are thinking differently than other people think, we're going to think now the way we ought to think in Christ, and that is that when somebody does us evil, we immediately do them good. We have to learn that there are certain things that belongs to man and certain things that belongs to God. And God said, one of the things that belongs to me is, I will take the vengeance. You do the good. So now, as we start tonight, before we ever open our mouth and read the first verse in chapter 13, let us know we're talking about vengeance. God says, don't you take it into your own hands. You leave it up to me. Now, with that, now, chapter 13, we'll start making sense here in just a moment down here. We'll just kind of leave it right there. And leave it there. Maybe you ought to peek down to verse 4. Peek down to verse 4 and find what word you see that we've been talking about. vengeance or an avenger. Right, an avenger. See, one who takes vengeance. Now, this is the civil government. That's what we're getting ready to see. Paul is getting ready to say the civil government takes vengeance. Don't you do it. Now, in chapter 12, God said, vengeance belongeth unto me. I will take the vengeance. All right, now we're going to learn in chapter 13 how God does that. God does that through civil government. Now, if we were to look at it right here in this way, let's suppose that right here is my lifetime. Now, here Randy comes along, and so he starts living here, and we're living right now together. All right, here I am, and down here is Randy. Now, Randy does something evil to me. As he does something evil to me, what is it I'm to do to him? I am to do good. Now, vengeance will be taken on Randy. What do we learn the meaning of that word vengeance is?
Justice.
Justice. Righteousness. The just thing will happen. Justice will happen to him. All right, now God said, though, Lowell, don't you take that into your own hands. He said, vengeance belongeth unto me. That is, unto God, and I will do it. All right, now there's two ways in which we can see the Bible teaches that God does that. Number one, what is going to happen to Randy out here at the end of time if he's that kind of a guy? See? And he just keeps doing this. Yes, we can see eternal damnation is vengeance. But that's not what this is talking about. This passage right here is talking about right now. So what God has done right here is God has ordained governments. And so every man, Randy and I, every person is living under governmental authority. And God has ordained the government to see that justice takes place. So that really is what the first part of chapter 13 is about. So with that in mind, let's read it here now. As we start out. By the way, before we do that, we might throw up our first transparency here. And I don't want to go back and read all of these passages that are back there, but they're passages that we'll call our attention to here. Back in Daniel chapter 4, Daniel is talking to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 and in chapter 5 and all of those verses, and he is telling this heathen king that it is God that rules in the kingdom of men. And he tells this heathen, it's God who set you up, and it's God who will remove you from the throne. That God can set up the lowliest of men, and he can destroy the most powerful of men. And so Daniel describes that to him. Now in Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 5 and 6, Habakkuk there is wondering why God is not doing anything about how terrible Israel is. And God said, I am doing a work in your day that is so wonderful that you wouldn't believe it if I told it to you. And then he said, lo, I raise up the Chaldeans. In other words, I'm raising up this nation to do a certain job. Isaiah 10 says that God uses the nation of Assyria to do it. Genesis chapter 13, verse 16, there we have another principle taught, that God destroys nations. Now in that verse, God told Abraham, now I'm going to take your people down into Egyptian captivity. I will keep them there for 400 years. Then at the end of 400 years, I'll bring them back up and give them the country of the Canaanites. Then God tells why he doesn't do that right now. Why is it God just didn't go ahead and destroy the Canaanites right at that time? Because your sins are not yet full. See, in other words, God said, I destroy a nation when their sins make them totally corrupt. So the Old Testament teaches that God rules the kingdom of men. Here in Romans 13, that we'll be talking about tonight, that teaches it. In Titus 3:1, he tells the Christians that they are to submit themselves into the higher powers. The same thing in 1 Peter chapter 2. In Jude 8, verse 8, there's only one chapter. And in 2 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 10, there we find that there is a very, very wicked, wretched, cruel, debauched type of an individual. Oh, he is talking about how horrible these people are. And one of the things that he says is, that they do not even blink an eye. They don't even give a second thought to rail or blaspheme dignitaries, that is, rulers. And so we need to understand that we do not have that right to rebel and blaspheme and talk about the dignitaries, because God has set these governments up. Now, as we start, I might ask you a question. Am I saying that all governments are set up by God, therefore all governments are righteous and good and pure? No, I'm not saying that at all. Governments are not righteous, good, and pure. But I could just as well say Jesus Christ established His church. Therefore, nobody in His church ever apostatizes, ever goes astray, ever becomes unrighteous. Is that right? No. See, the Bible teaches that that is not true. So, just because God set this up doesn't mean that people do not ruin it. God ordained marriage. There would not be such thing of marriage if God hadn't set up marriage. God made male and female. Marriage, from beginning to end, is from God and of God. Therefore, there are no bad marriages. No, that's not what we're saying. The same thing is true with government. God ordains government, but man has a tendency and a knack of ruining things. So as you look at bad governments, why, you can say, well, God surely didn't set that one up. Yes, He did. We're going to read it right here.
Okay, in this particular 2 Peter, mine says speak evil of dignities. Yours says dignitaries.
Well, dignities is the same thing.
Okay, yep. Well, is he saying do not speak evil of the system that God has inaugurated, or don't speak evil of those people who... Like, let's say, Stalin or something of this nature.
Gorbachev and so forth, people like this. Yeah, don't rail at them. Be careful in railing at them. Right. Now, you don't have to condone their unrighteous acts. Mm-hmm. See?
Yeah.
But don't go around and say, that dirty, low-down, rotten Gorbachev. You see?
Yeah.
That's railing.
Yeah.
You see, Eddie. Now, you can say President Bush or somebody did something the other day that I didn't think was right.
Okay, in other words, you're speaking respect.
You're speaking respect. That's right. See, I might talk about you, you see, and there's one thing of saying, boy, you know that no good low down, and the other thing is coming to you and saying, hey, I think that you did something the other day you really shouldn't have done. I'm showing respect, but the other way I'm railing at you, not showing that respect.
Mm-hmm. One thing along that line is, it's the position that is respectful. The man doesn't deserve respect. He's got a position. You better respect that.
You must respect the position. That's right. It's like a child with a dad. How should a child speak to a dad? Can a child ever tell a father you're wrong? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like governments, like for instance, the Roman occupation of all the lands that it had before Christ, and if that wasn't set up like that, whether they did good or not, if that wasn't set up like that, the gospel wouldn't have been able to get out as easily, because the language wouldn't have been...
That's true.
And Paul wouldn't have been around.
That's true. In the fullness of time, God sent His Son. Everything was just right, and that's true. But if you were looking at it from a Jew's viewpoint at that time, you would say that no good Caesar. See, that would be your tendency. So, what we're learning in here now is the renewing of your mind. The way to think in Christ. Alright, here now is what it said in verse 1. Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority, no government, no power, however you want to translate that word. The word literally means no authority, except from God. God has ordained every one of them. And those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority... Now, the word resist does not mean an occasional breaking of a law. And I'm not saying that you can occasionally break a law. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying it's okay to go out and pick out, you know, half a dozen laws and break them. But I'm saying that this word isn't talking about that. Randy, if your wife resists you, does that mean that she never does anything displeasing to you? No. She can do something and that's displeasing to Randy, And she might do something knowing that it's displeasing to him on a certain occasion. Well, I know Randy doesn't like this kind of bread, but I'm going to get it. You know, and so she gets it or does something of this nature. But the resist really means to stand against. That's the idea. That if she takes her stand against you, starts arguing with you and whatever you want, you know. And so this is talking about then rebellion against the government. Now, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. When you resist the government in that way, you are also resisting God because he set it up. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. So now, you're going to receive condemnation, and again, let's take Randy since we've got him pictured over there, in two ways. What will God do to him at the end of time? Obviously, he will be condemned. But what will the government do to him as God has set up the government and Randy is in rebellion against the government, will not pay his taxes, will not do this, will not file these papers, is going to overthrow the government? What's the government going to do to him? He's in trouble. And when he's in trouble, who is the originator of this? See? It is God. God set up the government for this purpose. Now, verse 3. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. You might say, well, there are, I know, sometimes, maybe, perhaps, you know, I mean, you can get out here, and we've seen some, like in Romania and things that just absolutely have shocked us. You know, we can't believe. There are governments, there are heads of governments, such as what, Ceausescu or something like that, the way you pronounce that name, just did things that is the human mind, a normal human mind, can't conceive of how he would do those particular things. What Paul is saying here is, now, that some of those people who were good, they were punished, they were scared to death of him. But is Paul here saying every ruler over every country will never do anything bad to any good person? No, that's not what he's saying. See, he's telling why you have this. Why should a man have a wife? Why does the Bible say? What? It's a helpmeet. Are there any wives that are not a helpmeet? That are a hurtmeet? Yeah, see? Sure there are. What is the normal? See, what is the purpose of that? So that's what this is saying. Now, rulers are a cause of fear for good behavior. Not a cause for good behavior, but of evil. Do you want to have no fear of authorities? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. Now, when you're going over this hill up here, and there's a radar trap that sets up here quite often, when does fear strike your heart? Now, I've never broken any laws myself, so I would never know this, but there are times that I go by a police car and I have no fear at all. There are other times when my heart goes, you know, when I look down and I'm over the speed limit. Now, why is that? Well, dumb question, right? We know why it is. When I go over a hill, have you ever done this? Have you ever obeyed the law in front of a policeman and made you feel good? I think all of us have. You know, we got our cruise control set, and over the hill we go. We see the policeman look down 55, and boy, just, you know, so happy, you know, that can be. Well, that really is what he's saying in here. So if you want to live your life in every realm, so that you're not living in fear and terror, always wondering when the door is going to be knocked down, then do that which is good. Because that's why government is here. It's here to punish the evil and to praise the good. He said, do what is good and you'll have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God. Now what's the it? The government. Do any of you have a translation that says he? Alright, now the reason that it says he is that in the Greek language, when you say, like when we speak in English, we say I, you, he, she, or it. See? Well, the third person is the, see, I'm the first person, always the first person, I. You, when you're talking to, is always the second. Then he, she, or it is always the third. Well, in every language, you have then the the three in there, masculine, feminine, and neuter. Because there's always three things in the third person. In English, we have different names. He and she. Now, there's not much difference in there, is there? We just put an S in front of the he for that. But he, she, and it. Now, the Greeks had one word. That's it. That they had one word, and it was a. And so when you said a, you look out there, then you have to look out and you decide, is it a he, she, or an it? And the context would tell you what it is. So, some of your translations then will have a he, they could have a she, or they could have an it. The context tells you. But it is so obvious, what is it we're talking about? The government, see, the power. So, for it is a minister of God. That word right there is the same word for deacon. It is a deacon of God. The word deacon means a servant, a minister, one who serves in whatever capacity that God would have you to serve in. The word is used in every realm. The word is used referring to Jesus Christ. The word is used referring to elders and preachers and men and women and apostles. Every conceivable job you can think of that you can do in service to God, that word will cover. And so he is a servant of God, then a minister of God to you for good. But if you do that which is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. Or some say he does not bear the sword in vain, which means for nothing. What would it mean if a policeman walks in here now and he has his 38 on, and somebody said, I wonder why he's wearing that 38, and somebody says, he doesn't have that on for nothing. Well, then he's got it on for something, hasn't he? That's the point. He's got it on to use what you use a 38 for. And so, if you don't want to be afraid of that 38 pistol, then do that which is good. See? Otherwise, that pistol is on there for what it is designed for. Now, what's the sword designed for? When did they use the sword? To behead an individual. So this is saying the government does not have the power of capital punishment for nothing. It has that power for use. Now, God has always demanded throughout a period of time that when man takes another man's life, that his life will be taken. In Genesis, the 9th chapter, long before the law was ever given, when Noah got off of the ark, that's one of the first laws that God gave. He said, now, from here on, there in the first three verses, did you know that? You could not take vengeance under the old law.
As an individual.
Now, what you had to do is the same thing you do under the new law. You take the individual down to the court, down to the civil government, down before the judge. Now, the judges under the old law had something that we don't have in American law because God gave that law there. The judges had no options. Now, today, if I kill you, well, the chances are it will be my punishment. 2 years, 5 years, since the first time I kill Randy, I'd probably get off for nothing. In other words, the judge will has a lot of leniency, right? All right, under the old law, now you take me down, and there's where it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth, and life for life. Now that was not given, Christy, to the individual. It was given only to the judge, and it was given so that the judges would not do what we do today. They were forced to. So, if I'm the judge, you bring somebody in, they kill somebody, it doesn't make any difference how much I love them, whether it's the first time, what it is, you die.
It's individual versus government.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, under the old law, it was exactly the same, really, as under the new. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Remember that rabbi that spoke up more?
What
congregation, remember? He talked about the history of what the Jewish nation was doing and how they got out of having to impose the death penalty. You remember that?
No. Tell me quick.
Well, they just had a really rational way for it, and they kept coming up with reasons why it wasn't necessarily murder, just take for instance. And so they got out of it, and they didn't have to impose the death penalty. And it was an interesting parallel to what we're doing in this nation today.
I see. Yeah. So I don't remember his explanation of that. I was so enthralled with some of the others that one skipped over. Right. Okay. Now, he goes ahead and says, "For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon those who practice evil." So the purpose of government then is really to punish the evildoer, to reward the good doer, but to protect the good person from the evil person. It has well been said that any government, regardless of how bad it was or is, any government is better than no government at all. Now what would happen if you had no government at all? Suppose that you go to Romania and they take the government, take them out, execute them as they did, and do not set up a new government. What would happen in Romania? Just mass murder, mass stealing. Nobody would be free to do anything. We see that every once in a while. We saw it in I think one of the hurricanes, wasn't it, that they had down on one of the islands just recently, where the government was not working and everybody was out there free, and then what happens all of a sudden? Even the law-abiding citizens, even businessmen, even the police, they had pictures taken of them of going in and stealing refrigerators and breaking into the shops and so forth. So, boy oh boy, if you did away with government, you can just know that tonight, even the policemen themselves, a good majority of them, would turn on the citizens and our life would be in chaos. So, in God's wisdom, in every nation, He has ordained that government will rule. Now, in verse 5, he said, "Wherefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake." So now there's two reasons why we need to obey the government. Number one is so we will not reap the horrible punishment that the government will inflict upon us. I should obey the speed limit, number one, so I don't have to pay that great big ticket that the government is going to give me. What's the other reason why I should? For conscience sake. Because I know that the government is ordained of God and you have to have rules and laws, and so I will help it and I will then obey it because I know it's set up by God. 6, for because of this you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. So that's the reason we have taxes, is to pay the government. Now, again, I realize that, are there any legitimate complaints against fraudulent use of your money and it irritates you for paying taxes? And surely, of course it is. Suppose John at the class night comes up here and slaps me. Is that fun? Would that irritate me? Now, what does Paul, though, tell me to do in the last chapter? Do him good. You see, turn around and do him good. But when I turn around and do him good, does that mean that I'm not irritated that he slapped me? I really enjoy, you see, having these things that no. And I don't enjoy seeing my tax dollars thrown away. And I don't enjoy seeing all of these things happen. But that is the price of government. You see, that's the price that the government has. And we say it is an abuse. Yes, I agree, it is an abuse. But what he's saying here is that's the reason that we do have these taxes then. Alright, now in verse 7, since he mentioned taxes, he's going to tell us some other things to do now. And taxes are brought up because it has to do with government itself. Alright, there are several things now that he's going to be talking about in this next chapter, these next verses, and that is, pay what is due, owe nothing except. There's one debt that you are perfectly permissible to owe. Now, first of all, when it says, render to all what is due them, that literally means pay your debts. That's all it means. Whenever your debt comes due, pay it. Tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. Now, the word tax means, and it's translated tribute in some translations, and it means the annual taxes on person and property. that if you live in a country, whether you owe anything or not, you're going to pay some kind of personal tax. If you do have property, you're going to pay tax on the property. That's the word to describe that. The next one is custom, and that is taxes or revenue that is levied on imports and trades that you have. It's kind of an interesting word. It is the word for end. It's telos. It's the word for end. And that's the normal word that they use. I would suppose that that is why that we call it custom. I mean, because as we make a product here, we get ready to sell it to Germany. When it leaves our country, the end, when the end comes, there's tax. I have to pay the taxes. And Germany then sends back over a product and I buy it. I'm importing it in. The end of their work, I pay a tax. And so I think it's interesting in there that that's the word there. All right, now the next is fear unto whom fear. Now there are certain people that stand in a position to where you should fear them. Can you name me one? A judge, a policeman, IRS, FBI, see, Jim Huntsberry back there. People that are in a position that where they can hurt you, they can cause you some trouble.
Mm-hmm. Is that where they're respected, or is that more of a...
The word is literally fear. Now, the word fear can mean either afraid or respect. And what I would take this to be, since there's nothing in the context that can show you what it is, I say both in there.
So it's the same word, but context would indicate.
That's right. Context tells you. In other words, a woman is to fear her husband, and it means respect, reverential respect, and so forth. And so there are people that are in positions to demand your respect. There are positions and people in position to demand your being afraid of them. The next is honor to whom honor is due. That is, there are certain people in positions of judges and presidents and congressmen and so forth. And so show them honor. Now, there may be a real reprobate, a real dishonest individual in Congress, and you know he's dishonest, and all the facts show he's dishonest, and if you say he's not dishonest, then you become a liar. So you would have to say the man is dishonest. But should you show him respect? Again, yes, because of the office that he is in. See, he demands that respect because of that. I think it comes back again to a child and parents. Some parents are dishonest, they are immoral, they are horrible, but a child should show them respect because of the position that they have one to the other. They were brought into the world and cared for. So honor whom honor. Then the next word says, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. Now, owe nothing literally means pay whatever debt is due when it is due. Some people read this and they think, well, it would be wrong to borrow money from the bank to buy my house or my automobile. Well, if I go down and I borrow $100,000 from the bank, do I owe anybody anything? Am I in violation of this? Do I owe anybody anything?
If you don't pay what you owe.
All right. Really, when I borrow, bank gives it to me, I sign there, and they've got, okay, now your first payment is due 30 days from now. Well, when I walk out, I ask, do you owe the bank anything? What can I say? Mm-hmm. Not today. You see? Not today. Don't owe them a dime. And when the payment becomes due, if I pay them, I do not owe them anything. What will happen if the bank decides I'm a bad risk, and so next year they call it in and they say, we want all of our money. What can I say?
Sorry,
I don't owe you anything. Don't owe you anything. If I miss the payments now, then it'll all be called in, but I don't owe you anything. So what it's talking about is not restricting any borrowing at all, but it's saying pay your debts and pay them when they're due. Now there is one debt that you have to mankind that you cannot pay, and that is the debt of love. So it said, owe no man anything except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. There's no way to really fulfill the law, be a law-abiding citizen, until you love your fellow man. Now, let's look at this, and we'll talk about love here then. It says, for this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, well, are there other commandments? Well, yeah, there are. So he said, now, if there are any other commandments, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's it. So he shows really how great love is. Now, in Matthew chapter 22, verse 36 and 37, they came to Jesus and said, what is the greatest commandment? That time Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy mind, all thy soul. And the second is likened to it, thou shalt love thy neighbor. That word means the one close to you, the one you have any relationship with. You shall love your fellow man as yourself. This over here is total absolute. This over here is, I should love you as myself. And Jesus then goes ahead and says, now on these two commandments hang the law and the prophets. Every commandment that is given, 100% of all of God's commandments, hangs on that law of loving God, or this law of loving man. And so, if you could say, I love God with all my heart, and I love man as myself, you can say you're perfect. Because then you have fulfilled everything that there is to fulfill. Now over here, notice the standard that is given. That thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. What did Jesus say in the Sermon on the Mount when he told you how to conduct yourself with people? What kind of standard did he give you? Do unto others as you would have them to do unto you. Which really is saying the same thing. So if I'm wondering, now, what should I do to Christy here in this particular situation? Maybe I'm upset. Maybe I feel that she's done something that she shouldn't have done and it has hurt me. When I determine now what am I going to do? What I have to say is, now, if I were in her shoes, what would I want her to do to me? Now, whatever I want her to do to me, that's what I will do to her. Isn't that loving yourself, loving her as loving yourself? See, if I said what she said, I'd certainly want her to come and tell me. But would I want her to come screaming and yelling? No, I wouldn't want her to come in screaming and yelling. Would I want her to come in accusing me of being malicious and ungodly and all this? No, I wouldn't want her to do that. How would I want her to come in? How do I want anybody to approach me if they're going to correct me? Gently, in the nicest way possible. See, now, when you say that command up there. Now you might say, but I was just correcting them. Yeah, you obeyed this other command. Yeah. Yeah, you obeyed Matthew 18, verse 15. If your brother sinned against you, you go to him alone. You obeyed that one, and you violated this one up here. You see, when you did that. So, boy, let's keep that in mind. And what would happen to the world or the church if every one of us obeyed that up there? Everything we did, everything we said, when we're here in this building and when we're home, every party we have, everything we do, we do it with that attitude and that disposition. How many problems would arise? Could not be any problems whatsoever. See, it's like loving God with all your heart. How many commands will you not obey? It can't be. So perfection is what you're talking about. All right. Now, as we continue on then here, we can see what love really is. Love, and if you don't know this, I want you to really look at it and get this definition down. Love is an attitude. It's not a feeling. Love is an attitude. Now, there's another word in the Bible, as we talked about Sunday morning, phileo, that it is a feeling that you have. It's a normal, natural feeling that you have that's brought out by whatever it is you love. But not this word. This word is an attitude that causes you to act. It causes you to do something. And the action must always be in the best interest of whatever you love. It has to be that way. And if you do not do that, then there's no need in saying that you love. Now this is a word that God commands us to love God, love our fellow man, love our wives, love our children, love our enemies. That's hard to do, isn't it? Somebody that actually is trying to do you harm, and they're trying to do it in a very immoral, despicable way, how can you love somebody like that? Well, you better. Now, what does that mean then? You act in their best interest. See, you have to act in their best interest. Does that mean you give them what they want? No, it didn't say that. If you love your children, you act in their best interest. That mean you give them what you want? No. Many times love demands that you don't give them what they want. But you have to consider that and say, now what would I want done if I were in that position? I guess you could get down really to something. Can you ever hit a man over the head with a tool before and say you love him? I can conceive of time doing that. Let's say this is a gun. Now, if I've got a gun, I'm mad at Oliver. Oliver speaks up right here. I've had enough of him anyway. I mean, he's been doing this quite some time. And I pull out this gun, and I am furious. And I'm getting ready to shoot him. Now, if Randy has a 2x4 right here, and he acts in my best interest, not in Oliver's. Now, he has to act in Oliver's too, but suppose just acting in my best interest, what would I want him to do to me?
There you go.
Would I want him to hit me over the head with a 2x4? Or let me go ahead and shoot Oliver and spend the rest of my life in Walla Walla. Let's talk about that before it ever happens. Let's talk about it right now, Randy. Let's just suppose we're talking. I say, Randy, if that ever happens, if I get so mad at Oliver now, sometimes I just get furious with him. Now, if you ever see me get so mad that I'm ready to shoot him, here's what I want you to do. Now, would I say, just let me shoot him? No. Randy, do whatever you need to do to stop me. Now, if you can hit me in the hand or knock the gun out without hitting my hand, do that. If you think you have to break my wrist, knock the gun out, go ahead. If there's no other way, you see, go ahead and do this thing. But sure, if that would be in my best interest for him to do that. So, these things, love is a pretty big word, isn't it? Pretty big word when you get to looking all around. Mm-hmm. John?
I have a subcontractor who does really bad work, and I make him do it over. He has a hard time realizing that's in his best interest.
Yeah, okay. Right, can't you just see John going up to this guy out there and say, now, I love you, and I'm going to make you do 3 days' work for nothing. But is it in his best interest?
Sure, but I don't do it.
Why, of course. You see, it's in his best interest for him to do that. So, love is the attitude that causes you to act in the best interest of whatever you love. Now, Paul sets forth some positive and negative things, both positive and negative, and here's what he says in here. He says, first of all, positively, is stated up here in verse 8. In verse 8, or is it? No, in verse 9 down there. You sum it up, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now there's a positive thing that I do. That I measure it, I say, okay, I will do whatever I would want them to do to me. Now the negative thing then, is what he then goes ahead to say down here is, love does no wrong, or love worketh no ill to a neighbor. Now that's the negative thing. Now, never, ever does love excuse you to wrong your neighbor or to do ill to them. Now, if Randy hits me over the head with a two before, has he wronged me? All right. The way I worded it, he couldn't answer it unless you put it back in the other. If Randy hits me over the head with a two before, has he loved me? Suppose tonight I'm walking down the office and he just said, I'll show him. Lets me have it, sends me to the hospital for 3 weeks. Now, that is not an act of love. But if I'm getting ready to do something that is going to hurt Oliver, or I'm getting ready to jump off of the Aurora Bridge and kill myself, he hits me over the head with a two before, sends me to the hospital for 3 weeks, he loves me. See? But the difference is he, in one case he was doing me wrong, in the other case he's not. All right. So those are the measuring sticks then that we would have along that line.
Well, yeah. Every occurrence of the word love there in English is from Gothi then.
Yeah, in here. Mm-hmm. Right. All right. And now in verse 11. He said, and this do. Now here's something else that you do. Knowing the time that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. Now, he's trying to wake them up out of their lethargy. Do faithful Christians need to be woken up once in a while? Now, I'm not talking about the immoral people, but I'm talking about the most zealous Christians you know. Yes. Timothy needed to have his fire stirred up, and Paul told him, you know, to do this thing. So sure, yeah, we all get a little lax in there. So that's what he's saying. It's time to wake up. Now, it's time to get busy doing what you should do. Now, why is it time to get busy doing what you should do? What is it we should be doing? What are we talking about? We're not talking about loving. We're not talking about vengeance. We're not talking about government. What are we talking about? That's right. Presenting your bodies as a living sacrifice. And why is that so important? Because of what God did for me. See, God has saved me, a horrible sinner, and He has saved me freely. See, done this. Now, I have a responsibility. So, wake up, see, and get to doing certain things. All right, here's what it is. Knowing this, knowing the time, think about it. The hour is already there for you to awaken from your sleep. For now, salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. Oliver, when were you converted?
10 years.
10 years ago. Are you closer to the judgment now than what you were then?
10 years closer.
If you're 10 years closer. See, that's just it. We really should think about this quite often. When you go to bed at night, you ever go to bed and think, well, here is another day. I'll never live. I'm 24 hours closer to meeting God than I was when I went to bed last night. That's a good way to go to bed. And it's a good way to get up. Thinking, now, today, I'm 24 hours from what I was yesterday. Yesterday, I was a little lethargic, pretty lazy. I didn't do some things that I should do. I'm 24 hours closer to meeting Him. And so what he's telling us is that every one of us fall into that category, that we get closer and closer and closer every day of our life. Now, 12. The night is almost gone, and the day is at hand. He's looking at our life now as a day. And so, the night is almost gone. That is that you've been sleeping long enough now. And so, it's day has come. It's time for us to get up and take this thing seriously. Do what God would have us to do. Let us therefore lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Now, deeds of darkness and armor of light would not be intelligible unless we knew what they stand for. What does darkness stand for? The kingdom of darkness. In a Colossian letter, we're translated out of the kingdom of darkness.
What would be anything evil or sin?
Evil, sin, and ignorance. Those are three things that it is used for. Of course, evil and sin being the same thing. So sin and ignorance. If you come up and say, Lowell, I want to ask you a question about this, and I say, you know, I don't know, I'm in the dark about that. What did I say? I'm ignorant about that. I do not know anything. Well, why does darkness stand for ignorance and light stand for knowledge?
Because Well, just a simple light illuminates.
Right, light illuminates. When you're in the light, you can see. It would be the same as if the lights went out. I'm over there at the door. If there's somebody here that doesn't know the layout of this room, and I would ask them, would you lead me through the room without tripping over the chairs? He'd say, I can't. You know, I mean, I'm in the darkness, literally. So I can't do it. I could say, well, let's do it. See? Because I have been in the light. I understand the situation. Now, if you flip on the light, can that man lead me through here without ever? Yes. See, so what does light do? It enables you to see and accumulate knowledge. So what it's talking about then is ignorance and sin. So now it's time to lay aside the darkness of whatever sins you have, whatever ignorance you have, and get busy putting on righteousness and knowledge. Learning what God would have you to do and start doing that very thing. The negative side, the positive and negative, let us behave ourselves as in the day. Now what's the difference of people behaving themselves in the day and at night? When do the carousers go out? It's in the night. As you go down and you see a bar, what is the telltale sign of a real bad, raunchy place? No windows. That's the sign that will tell you. Now, you walk in, and how's the light situation? Have you ever noticed that in taverns and so forth, they don't have enough money to get good 100-watt bulbs? They're all 25-watt bulbs that are in there. No, there's a reason for that. Wickedness loves darkness and loves light and so forth. So that's what he's saying. So let us behave ourselves as in the day. When you're in the daytime, people can see you. That's when you're going to behave. Now, not in carousing. Now, carousing there really means what we mean by carousing. That's what it's talking about. It is an immoral, uninhibited lifestyle. That's the idea. Just uninhibited, going out, doing whatever you want to. Now, if a person is a carouser, if they're going out and just uninhibited, if we like it, let's do it. How many times will drunkenness be involved with those kind of people? Just about 100% of the time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The only time I think that it wouldn't be is if a person had some kind of an allergy, and if they took a drink, why, it'd make them deathly sick, and I don't know very many people like that. But I mean, you might be able to find somebody, that's the point I'm trying to make, somewhere. I've never heard one. But when you find carousing, you find drunkenness. Now, not in sexual promiscuity. That word is kind of interesting in the Greek. It's not in bed. That's what it says. And so it is a terminology like we would use a guy sleeping around. Well, there's nothing wrong with sleeping, is there? And there's nothing wrong with around. I mean, every time I take a trip, I stay in a motel in Portland, stay in one in San Francisco, stay in one somewhere else. I'm sleeping around. You see, but no sleeping around, you see, doesn't carry that connotation to it. Now, that's the same way with this right here. See, it is sexual promiscuity. That's what he's talking about. Yeah. Chambering. And what is chambering in your Bible? What does that mean?
Bed chambers.
Yeah, bed. Mm-hmm. That's right. Talking about the bedroom. All right. So, don't engage in illicit sex and sensuality. What's that?
Lust.
All right, lust. It's fulfilling your physical desires. See? I'm just trying to fulfill your physical desires. Not in strife and jealousy. Now, in strife and jealousy, that could either be in the physical domain or it could be really in the church. With good people, can it? In other words, without carousers and so forth, there can be lots of strife and jealousy and bickering, fussing, fighting, and so forth. Those are not the kind of people that God wants. See, we're not to become engaged in that kind of a thing. But in the realm of your carousers, are there any bickering and strife and jealousy in that realm, that crowd? Oh yeah. See, that's what it's made up of too. So what he's saying is, All of these things that appeal to the flesh, all of these things that are physical weaknesses, get away from them. And 14, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provisions for the flesh in regard to its lust. Now the word make no provision is don't make any forethoughts. Don't make any foreplans. Don't start planning how I can fulfill the lust of my flesh. You see, that's there. Now, you say, well, what does it mean? Well, it's like this. Let me come back here to Oliver. Now, it may be after class, Oliver gets up and says something, and I turn around and I bite his head off, and I see him that's up here. But I haven't planned on it. Now, suppose though that today I made plans, Oliver will be here tonight, and I'm going to catch him in here somewhere, and I'm going to tell him off. See? Well, if I'm that kind of a guy, of course, I'm making provisions, you see, to satisfy myself. And I make provisions to satisfy my sexual desires and my drunken drinking desires and all of these various things. So use your mind. Don't ever make provisions for that. Make all your provisions to serve your Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Okay, any comment or question?
Mm-hmm. Earlier, I was thinking about this. I can't figure it out in my mind, so I'll bring it out. You talked about obeying the two commandments that Jesus talks about in Matthew 22. But if you do all those, love God with all your heart, you love your fellow man as yourself, that you wouldn't have any problems?
No. Well, no, I didn't say it. No, you wouldn't do any sin.
You wouldn't do any sin.
Yeah, no, you can
still help. Because I was thinking about the disagreement that Paul and Barnabas had over John Mark. I mean, that was a real sharp dispute.
Oh, yeah.
And so... Okay.
Yeah, Jesus had problems.
Right. So you just meant sin, I guess.
Yeah. No. You won't commit any sins. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Class dismissed.